And now we want to attend to our guest poet who's bussed down here from Milwaukee last night. His bus broke down, and then he was treated to a ramshackle ride on the labyrinth of highways and byways and back roads to the cow pasture in Arnold, and said a few words over the air on DHX. Antler is probably best known for his long poem Factory, which City Lights published in 1980 and sort of unleashed into the world of poetry one of the themes that he's continued, and that's an assault and revision of the work ethic and work consciousness. Work is one of the big themes in his work, along with the theme of nature, meditations on both the process, the alternating process of life and death. He is the recipient of the Walt Whitman Award. Actually, it's a different Walt Whitman Award than the one that Eric Pankey won. Eric's award was Academy of American Poets gives that Walt Whitman Award. Antler's award is awarded by the Mickle Street Review, which comes out of Camden, New Jersey. It's a magazine dedicated to Whitman's work and coming out of his hometown in Camden. And Whitman is often invoked in articles about Antler's poetry. Whitman is unavoidable when you encounter Antler's work. It's in his long line and his big spirit, in his relationship to nature and to the universe. There are other echoes in Antler's work. Rex Roth is there. Snyder is there. Robinson Jeffers is there. But it's all filtered through a very unique and very large consciousness and spirit that I've had the pleasure of just getting to know in the last less than 24 hours, and already feels like an old friend, and I think you'll feel close to him after you hear him. So please welcome, for the first time in St. Louis, the poet Antler.
Hi. But it's nice to be here, and I'd like to thank Michael and River Styx and Duffs for making it possible for me to come here from my hometown of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Milwaukee means gathering place of the waters in Potawatomi, because three rivers meet and enter Lake Michigan, where the sewage treatment plant is now. And one of the thoughts that has been in my mind since I came here is the arch. And to me, it occurred to me, I wondered if, since it's been built, if the suicide rate of this area has gone down. Because there's something very harmonious and graceful about it, which I would think that people who were very melancholy and wanted to depart from this sphere would be uplifted by it. And I wondered if anyone had done a study on that. Well, tonight I'm going to read poems from my book, Last Words, which I have some copies of here if anyone wants to get. And this is a book of meditations on death, love, work, freedom, and the wilderness. And so I'm going to read poems which reflect each of those themes. Last words. As this girl lay asleep on the beach, an ant crawled up her nose and laid its eggs. And when they hatched and ate into her brain, she clawed away her face and died screaming. Or that deep sea diver whose pressurized suit burst, who has squeezed a liquid pulp of flesh up the air hose onto the deck, a long strand of human spaghetti. Or that man on a Japanese train killed by the severed leg of a suicide who jumped from a passing train 100 miles an hour through his window. Or Li Po launching himself like a paper boat toward the moon. Or Aeschylus strolling along the shore when an eagle looking for a stone to crack a turtle shell spotted his pate gleaming in the sun. Or that Pompeii boy immortalized in lava. Or the unearthed coffin, the lid scratched and bloody inside. Or abandoned by his family, the old Eskimo circled by wolves. Or Superman, no longer faster than a speeding bullet through his head. Or Santa's helicopter crashing in a shopping center of expectant children. Or six children trampled to death in Cairo by a mob rushing to the church where the Virgin had just appeared. These deaths speak for themselves. They don't need last words. As for me, I'm not looking into the sky for falling flower pots. Yet any second, sights of a rifle may fix on my brain. 14 humans walked alive that day. A perfect stranger by the name of Whitman, up in a tower of higher learning, shot them down one by one, just like that, dead. I think of that old man, stoned by three children who jeered him out of his house. If someone told me that's how I die in 50 years, I wouldn't believe it. Did anyone tell the old man? How will I die? Cleaning a gun with my eyes? Walking into a mirror? Driving into a tree to avoid a porcupine, my learner's permit in my pocket? I know the old philosophies. Yes, I've already died in a way, my boyhood and all that. Showers of fingernails and hair, the constant sloughing off of the cells of my body, the death of all the semen that has left me, my turds moving to their own bewildered death. Maybe it'll be like that first night in San Francisco, waking up to go to the bathroom in Milwaukee, and getting out of my old bed, I walk into a new wall. Maybe it'll be coming up or going downstairs in the dark, thinking there's one more step when there isn't, or not one more step when there is. Will I choke on a bone or be swallowed by a whale or a death brimming with illusions? Tugging a book from the tightly packed shelf, I pull my whole bookcase over on me. Or slow deaths, torture, cancer, leprosy, senility. Or exotic, voodooed, cannibalized, human sacrificed, devoured by man-eating plant. Which is worse, being eaten alive or starving to death? Dying, crying for help, or begging for mercy? Yawning as the bomb drops in my mouth, sneezing in the avalanche zone, dunning by hiccups that can't be stopped, boarding the Titanic, assured it's unsinkable, or like in Steckel, that man who hid under the outhouse seat and disemboweled his wife from beneath with a butcher knife. I look before sitting. Or seeing my ultimate vision of absolute beauty, I scream as in horror comics, arg! Will I die laughing? Be struck by lightning? Will I never know what hit me? Maybe the sky will fall on me. Maybe the ground will just open up under me. Maybe a gang of boys will pour gasoline over me and light me. Or will it be a case of spontaneous combustion? Will I be mistaken for a deer during deer season? Or like Tita Piaz, who climbed 9,000 feet of sheer rock 300 times with his son strapped to his back, only to die in a fall down his steps. And when am I going to die? I'd like to know. I don't want to get there when the show's half over. I don't want to fall asleep. I'll have to poke myself. I don't want to miss my death the way I missed my birth. I sit here and plan my last words. I'm going to be prepared, as in murder mysteries where the victim lies dying, and the hero holds him and says, "Who did it?" In the same way, they'll gather around me and ask, "What does this poem mean?" Or, "Do you really think that is beautiful?" And then, like the murdered victim, I'll mumble far away, feverishly trying to think of something profound and rising in pitch gasp, it was. Then slumping back, I die. What will I say? Shall I make fart sounds with my lips? Should I tell where the treasure's hidden? Should I utter Wanbli Galeshka, Wananiheohoi, my best friend's name? Or make-believe death rattles better than bird lovers warble songs of their favorite birds? Or should I join the chorus of thousands who shriek, "Ayi," or the thousands who simply go, "Oh," or "Ugh," or "Oof," or "Whoops"? Or should I press finger to lips in the sign of silence? Not content with ruling the world, Nero, wanting to be its supreme actor and musician, ordered full houses and awarded himself all the prizes. And while he sang, no one could leave, though many pretended to die in order to be carried out as corpses. Shall I say, as he did when forced to commit suicide, "What a great artist the world is losing"? Or like Rabelais, "Bring down the curtain, the farce is finished"? And later, as the priest surrounded him, he with a straight face sighed, "I go to seek a great perhaps." Or like the Comtesse de Vercelles, according to Rousseau, in the agonies of death, she broke wind loudly. "Good," she said, "a woman who can fart is not yet dead." Or like St. Boniface, as boiling lead was poured down his throat, "I thank thee, Lord Jesus, Son of the living God." Or St. Lawrence, broiled on a gridiron, "This side is done now, turn me over." Or Emily Dickinson, "I must go in, the fog is rising." Or Badeau's, "I ought to have been, among other things, a good poet." Or Lindsay, full of Lysol, "They tried to get me, I got them first." Or Socrates, "Crito, I owe a cock to Asclepius. Will you remember to pay the debt?" Or Chopin, "Swear to make them cut me open so I won't be buried alive." Or Scriabin, his face engulfed in gangrene, "Suffering is necessary." Or Marie Antoinette, having stepped on the executioner's foot, "I beg your pardon." Or Huey Long, "I wonder why he shot me." Or Millard Fillmore, "The nourishment is palatable." Or P.T. Barnum, "How are the receipts today in Madison Square Garden?" Or Carl Panzarm, slayer of 23 persons, "I wish the whole human race had one neck and I had my hands around it." Or Jean Barre, 19, guillotined for mutilating a crucifix, "I never thought they'd put a gentleman to death for such committing such a trifle." Or Da Vinci, "I have offended God and man because my work wasn't good enough." Zeno, founder of the Stoic school, striking the ground with one fist, "I come, why do you call for me?" W. Palmer, stepping off the gallows, "Are you sure it's safe?" Metchnikoff, the bacteriologist, "Look in my intestines carefully, for I think there is something there now." John Wilkes Booth, "Tell my mother I died for my country." Dylan Thomas, "I've had 18 straight whiskeys, I think that's the record." Dutch Schultz, "French-Canadian bean soup." Byron, "I want to go to sleep now." Joyce, "Does nobody understand?" Must I be the scribe of each word I speak, never knowing if it will be my last? Or should someone else be my full-time scribe in case death fits keep me from writing them down, always ready to put ear to my lips in case it should be a whisper? Rosebud. More weight, more light. Now it has come. Now I die. So this is death? Thank you. Farewell. Hurrah. Boo. Can this last long? It is finished. Or like H.G. Wells, I'm all right. Go away. Or like Sam Goldwyn, I never thought I'd live to see the day. Or like John Walcott, when asked if anything could be done for him, bring back my youth. I tell myself what my last words will be, hoping I don't get stage fright, hoping I don't get laryngitis, hoping someone will hear them, hoping I'm not interrupted, hoping I don't forget what they are. From now on, everything I say and write are my last words. Thank you. This is the poet pipe. This is the poet pipe. This is the pipe of poetry. I offer it to be smoked by all the poets I love. I offer the best grass in the world for the sacred ceremony. We will pass the pipe in a circle for centuries on centuries. The seasons shall come and go as we smoke ourselves into being. We will smoke the marijuana that grows from the graves of our ancestors. Their immortality shall make us high. Now I'm going to read a few poems that are, in a way, from a sequel to my factory poem called Reworking Work, which is a kind of poetic, philosophical manifesto invoking the unbrainwashing of the work ethic. It's funny. They call a factory a plant, and yet they call marijuana a drug. Whereas to me, marijuana is a plant, and the factory is the drug. And it seems to me like Western civilization is drugged on this miraculous factory system, which is now polluting and destroying the earth. And so these are poems that were written in some way as a response to questions or criticisms made about my factory poem. And this is the first one. Written after learning, slaves in ancient Greece and Rome had 115 holidays a year. Instead of creating better murder weapons to protect ourselves, better create loving boys and girls who become loving women and men. Instead of a higher standard of living, why not a higher standard of loving? Why not a higher standard of getting high? No more brainwashed robot zombies. No more socialization lobotomies. Thoreau could live a whole year on money from working 6 weeks. We canned ourselves in concentration camps called cities and in buildings and rooms where we work. We have become hermetically sealed containers. The can of today is the wilderness that was. The can to be is the wilderness that is. As Oscar Wilde said, work is the curse of the drinking man. As Stan Jones said, it's not what the machine makes, but what the machine makes you. As Virgil said, Deus nobis haec atia facit, a god has granted us this idleness. As Lessing said, let us be lazy in everything, except in loving and drinking, except in being lazy. Should cans stop being made? Should all factories immediately close down? What solution do you provide? If everyone's a poet and no one works, how do we survive? The way Saint Teresa survived on light. Love becomes a full-time job. But where do we get the money to pay people not to work? Slaves in ancient Greece and Rome had 115 holidays a year. Hey, wait a minute. That makes us more slaves than them. Well, a book that had a big influence on me is called Stone Age Economics by Marshall Solins, an anthropologist. And in that book, he presents really convincing evidence that Paleolithic peoples only had to work 15 hours a week to satisfy all their needs. And I thought about that, and I'm still thinking about that. And this is a poem that is thinking about that. And it's called 0 Hour Day, 0 Day Work Week. Are the executives of oil, steel, aluminum, plastic, military, industrial, capitalism to be looked up to as great men and women to be held as fitting examples of enlightened human beings? Or are they miserable failures of greed who betray the earth and the promise of America? Is who invented napalm to be honored? Is who invented nerve gas to be honored? Slavery did not end. Almost everyone enslaved to earth death accomplice jobs. A new Emancipation Proclamation is needed. Liberation from an 8-hour day, 5-day work week to a 5-hour day, 1-day work week, getting paid the same amount. Or how about a 12-hour day, 7-day play week? Or maybe keep only the least harmful factories, and everyone has to factory once for a year, the rest of their life free to learn and create, travel to wilds and other lands, like Huxley's Island. We think working 8 hours a day, a great advance over the time when workers, even children, worked 14 hours a day for lousy wages and conditions. It is better, but 8 hours a day is still too long. Our lives should be free, a continual vacation. Anyone had to work all their life and had a 2-week vacation every year has been robbed. Anyone who had to work 6 months a year and had a 6-month vacation has been robbed. Anyone who had to work 1 day a year and had a 364-day vacation has been robbed. Only total vacation will do. Expand wilderness, reduce population, reduce production. Anyone who says it can't be done is performing what I call the ghost dance in reverse. We can shape the image of man we desire. We can shape the image of boy we desire. We can shape the image of girls and women in America and world peace and wilderness vision quest enlightenment we desire. A 12-hour day, 6-day work week becomes a 10-hour day, 6-day work week, becomes an 8-hour day, 5-day work week, becomes a 6-hour day, 4-day work week, becomes a 4-hour day, 2-day work week, becomes a 1-hour day, 1-day work week, becomes a 0-hour day, 0-day work week. People should be paid not to work. People should be paid to play. People should lie in hammocks and sip lemonade all day. Most people are too busy working or resting from work to work on their own mind growth, poet, enchil. But, my mother asks, what about workers who like their jobs? Happy they receive so much money to buy all the amazing things factories make, not to mention the benefits they get for medical protection in old age. It's not religion that's the opium of the people, but work. Work is the opium of the people. Oh, workers of the world, stop working. Think of the whales, more intelligent than Einstein or Bach. who never have to work a fucking second of their incredible life. Well, as Mark Twain once said, I don't like work even when the other fellow does it. And Sri Ramakrishna has a nice meditation on work where he says, one should have a yearning for God, like a man who has lost his job and is rushing from office to office in search of work. And then there's that old Spanish proverb, how beautiful it is to do nothing and then to rest afterward. This one is called For the Recognition of the Role of the Poet in Society. James Dickey once said, poets inspired by Ginsberg or Bligh would be better off to society employed as garbage collectors. What an insult, I thought, till I learned garbage collectors in California make $25,000 a year. And a poet, after cost of paper, pencils, pens, envelopes, stamps, Xeroxing, on the average makes minus $1,000 a year. But poetry is great, greater than most poets realize. Enough poets have scrawled dead poet on their t-shirts and jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. As there is the expression to put someone to death, poetry's purpose is to put someone to life. What kind of society can you expect where poets make less than garbage collectors? Wouldn't that make poetry less than garbage? Wouldn't that make parents want their children to go up to be garbage collectors rather than poets? Poets are more important than presidents. Poets are more important than executives. Poets are more important than even most poets realize. Here's something I always wondered. Why no poet wanted in want ad section? Those who regard it an affront, you write poems and aren't working. As if writing poems and being a poet were not valid work in our society. As if poetry has no value. Especially when you write, factories are boxcars full of Jews. Especially when you invoke a marijuana blowjob religion. Especially when you place solitude, wilderness, vision quest above all the works of man. They want you to get a job you don't like and have to be working full time so you can't write anymore. They want you to confess your poetry is full of shit. Somehow your writing threatens them. Besides, Christ already said it all. So don't bother trying to say something new that's true. What are the words of a mere mortal next to the Son of God's? Well, certain aesthetes have criticized poems like my factory poem for being narrative, philosophical, ecological, political, as if those modes of writing poetry were obsolete. And the only poetry that had any merit was that which was barely intelligible or completely unintelligible. And this is my response to those people. Your poetry's no good because it tries to convey a message. Tell it to Jews hanging from meat hooks. Tell it to Wilfred Owen's exploded face. Tell it to James Wright's cancerous cut-out tongue. Tell it to Victor Jara's hands chopped off in Santiago Stadium. Tell it to all the ears, breasts, cocks, and balls cut off in every war. Tell it to all the beautiful eyes gouged out in every war. Tell it to the pyramid of human skulls that never stops growing. Tell it to the decapitated head held up to gape twitching corpse jeering crowd. Tell it to the fact we're all in Auschwitz because any second every city can become Holocaust. Tell it to Hetch Hetchy. Tell it to Glen Canyon. Tell it to Wounded Knee and the Buffalo. Tell it to the aluminum fibers in your brain and the cancer in your food and water, which will eventually kill you. Tell it to 100 trillion cigarettes a year. Tell it to 100 billion spent on war every minute. Tell it to Johnny Got His Gun. Tell it to the ashes of Neruda's library. Tell it to 52 million children under 15 working in factories in Southeast Asia. Tell it to more people born in 2984 than all the people ever born. Tell it to the annihilated white pine dominions of Wisconsin. Tell it to the sequoias still standing who were alive 1,000 years before the Bible was written. Tell it to all the unexperienced homosexual joy since Christianity came into power. Tell it to the $100,000 it cost to kill each soldier in World War II. Tell it to Henry Ford's factory in France that made tanks for the Third Reich. Tell it to the sunrise. Tell it to the rainbow. Tell it to the flower made love to by the bee. Tell it to the waterfall that never stops telling. Tell it to the combers that never cease crashing. Tell it to the reflection of stars in the rain-filled black bear track. Tell it to the canyons that echo, the canyons that echo. Tell it to bird song, whale song, wolf song, cricket song. Tell it to the clouds as they float overhead. Yell it to the lightning, bell it to the thunder, well it to the pouring rain. Spell it on kindergarten blackboard, knell it to firefly cemetery dusk. Tell it to tombstones who have forgotten their names. Tell it to the shadow of your breath cloud on a winter day. Tell it to mother harp seals while their babies are skinned alive. Tell it to the naked black youth being hung by white lynch mob while they point and laugh. Tell it to the geniuses who invent better and better methods of mass murder. Tell it to the stockpiles of suicide pills to be dispensed in the event of apocalypse. Tell it to the fact more women raped in America every year than poetry books sold every year. Tell it to the statistics of ecocide, genocide, suicide. Tell it to Kennedy's brain fragments quivering on the Dallas street. Tell it to Sylvia Plath's head in the oven. Tell it to Lorca while a soldier fires two bullets up his ass. Tell it to Ishii on the LA freeway during rush hour. Tell it to Black Elk on Times Square at midnight on New Year's Eve. Tell it to the blue whales and redwoods murdered by harpoons and buzzsaws. Tell it to the shadow graphs in Hiroshima. Tell it to the poets on Skid Row. That's all I'm going to read of my other work, Meditations. This next poem is called Puberty of Smell. And when a friend of mine came back from Vietnam, he returned to the factory where he was working before he was drafted. And after his first day back on the job, he went back to his parents' house where he was living, locked himself in his bedroom. And his mother knocked, asked if he wanted some dinner, and there was no answer. And a few seconds later, she heard a shot, and he had killed himself. And this is a poem I wrote for him. And it takes place by a waterfall in central Wisconsin on the Wolf River, called Big Smoky Falls. The puberty of smell. If the second before pulling the trigger, you remember me. Remember me smelling lilacs. How every time smelling lilacs, I remember the time my mescaline olfactory system caught on the early morning breeze the full blossomed and blossoming lilacs at Big Smoky Falls. How my nose approached like a boy discovering his cock feels so good he can't help crying out. How circling the tree at nose level, caressing with my nose those purple clouds of fragrance, I experienced where I smell inside my skull, above my mouth and under my eyes, in the very center, my nose's first orgasm. Not caring if anyone saw my abandon, though no one was there. No one but birds and songs, the sun rises in them, and the falls, and the song of the falls, and the song of mosquitoes I gave my blood to with joy. And even if I didn't think then of the scent between pubescent legs, or remember my boyhood cock no longer exists to caress breasts of early morning dreams, I saw them opening, all opening and opening themselves, and glowing in the sun's first rays, lifting themselves to the sun in the just felt breeze, as if they'd waited, as if everything in the universe had waited till I came, till I could smell them opening, my nose caressed by those blossoms, those lilacs, those clusters of fragrance, and the living color called purple. As I opened and closed my eyes with my breathing, every so often remembering where I was, remembering I had a face, and that face had a nose. For didn't it seem to me then all I was that smell? Jim, even if you've already killed yourself, when the time comes you have my name and I have yours, write this for me. Or when next you're about to pull the trigger, remember in that second before you discover, if you can hear the shot, that for a few grains of the hourglass, this was me. That I too had no choice, drawn by the smell irresistible, my nose approaching like the lover who believes no one on earth can love more passionately. Remember me then, smelling so hard as if I were the first to aroma this peculiar translation of corpses, as if I were the first to make love to lilacs, as if I were entering strange houses of early morning, drawn towards sleeping boys to hold lilac sprigs to nostrils of their dreams, as if I discovered the answer to all the questions the universe inside my skull could ask. And so in the second before you blow out your brain, when you look into the gun and feel where the hole in your head will be, remember you were immortal before you were born, that even before this poem, your suicide must be fragrant as lilacs. And always remember in that morning the color of lilacs, how I smelled them till I could smell them no more, withdrawing, fulfilled, and wondering, if you went to those lilacs at Big Smoky Falls, you'd be surprised they had no smell, because I must have inhaled it all, wondering if I'd smell those purple clouds so well, if you inhaled from my nose, you could smell them now. Many scholars have devoted time and energy to try to fathom the sexuality of Walt Whitman, and some felt if they could only really prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Whitman was a homosexual, that that would disqualify his poetry. And this is I'm a Whitman scholar in a certain way, and this is my response. Whitman, sexual. Whitman was a boy sexual, a girl sexual, a woman sexual, a man sexual, a grass sexual, a tree sexual, a sky sexual, an earth sexual. Whitman was an ocean sexual, a mountain sexual, a cloud sexual, a prairie sexual, a birdsong sexual, a lilac smell sexual, a galloping horse sexual. Whitman was a darkness sexual, a sleeper sexual, a sunrise sexual, a Milky Way sexual, a gentle breeze sexual, an open road sexual, a drum tap sexual, a wilderness sexual, a crossing Brooklyn Ferry sexual, a sands at 70 sexual. Whitman was a farewell my fancy sexual, a luckier than was thought sexual, a death sexual, a corpse watch sexual, a compo sexual, a poets to come sexual, a miracle sexual, an immortality sexual, a cosmosexual, a waiting for you sexual.